Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We've been answering questions that Nick has had about things in the Torah. That my last explanation took all of the 6-minute segment, Nick, so I'm just going to give you the opportunity to comment or challenge that answer. I'd love to listen to your response.
One question, though?
You okay?
I think Okay,
before we move to your next question, can I at least, since we still have Glenn with us, and I think Glenn's participation in the previous answer was so helpful that I'd like to get Glenn's, because I'd like this, when this is a discussion and we're all contributing to understanding, I think we are well served. And so, Glenn, I augmented your answer, your previous one, which I thought was great, by the way. Now I want to give you the opportunity to augment or even to challenge anything that I said in that last segment.
No, that's fine. You know, Nick likes posing problems that would cross a rabbi's eyes. He's just fiddling on the roof there, you know.
Yeah.
That's why
he's not making a living at it.
Make the point that it was from Fiddler on the Roof.
Briefly,
to harken back to the Onan story real quick, just momentarily.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up, I thought it was odd that there was a company that made gas-powered generators for, like, RVs called Onan. You know,
they make generators for boats too. I've been a boater for much of my life. I'm not anymore. You know, the happiest day in a boater's life is when he sells his last boat. And so I'm now a very happy non-boater. But owning generators are prolific in the marine world. But you're right.
I wonder why anybody would want to name something. Yeah, boats a hole in the water into which one pours money. But anyway,
yes.
Okay.
Another 1,000 is what the acronym BOAT means.
Exactly. So anyway, back to your original question.
Yes.
This is one of those toughies that, and I hadn't gotten this version, of what, transpired until college. You know, the churches aren't big on going into this one either because of, the sexual issue involved.
Right.
Some people prefer to try and, say that it was merely seeing, Noah's making this kind of bad attitude about it. And obviously, this is clear.
No.
It's just many people are uncomfortable with this one. But in terms of anything I might have to add,
This is a great example, though, Glenn, of how you have to put together the pieces, where you have to look at the other two places and saw his nakedness were stories were actual stories of incest. And they were also stories of losing control and no longer being responsible because of drunkenness. And then you have to put that together with why Yahweh is so opposed to incest. And then even connect that to his second statement that he etched in stone that talked about fathers corrupting their children to the second and third generation. And then third and fourth generation. And even then you have to think about, what was it about the Canaanites that caused their iniquity to be full?
Right.
And perverse sexuality, when sexuality involves incest and pedophilia, that goes right to the heart of what God despises in terms of behavior. He doesn't go out of the way to talk about much behavior to condemn it. He does say, he doesn't like bestiality and then the like. But when you're dealing with incest and pedophilia, this is incest, not pedophilia, but it probably was perpetrated on the son, Canaan, by the father, making it both. God really, really dislikes this.
By contrast, one of the things that really struck me in learning about child development child psychology and child developmental psychology was how much the personality of the child is, how that child derives so much security from a secure relationship between the parents.
Right.
And that just is really, as opposed to, and when you look at all these you know, when you look at all these aberrations, you know, if you have, when you have, you know, the husband and wife, the parents, you know, loving each other, being mutually supportive of each other, you know, presenting a united front and raising the child, this gives, you know, the child's tremendous sense of security. And when these things are violated, when the relationship, when there's alienation between husband and wife, when there's sexual transgressions, where the sex being so powerful, when the child is victimized, and you see all of the psychological aberration that results from this sort of thing, and then with incest, and then you have, you know, the Down syndrome pregnancies and stuff, you see why God was just, don't do this. You know,
yeah. Family is the single most important thing to him. Second is probably trust. And seeing him as our father and the role of a nurturing and loving father that tries to do the best for his children and trusting him to do that are so important that when those things are broken through our abuse sexually of our own children, that's a real serious crime. It hits right to the heart of what Yah was trying to teach us. All well spoken, Glenn. So you had another question, Nick?
Nick? You opened up a little.
Okay.
Isn't he, Yahweh, says that, don't keep on doing these kind of things in terms of,
right,
like, once is okay. So
he doesn't ever say once is okay. In the, what you're mistaking here, that's a good point. It's a good point. Let me finish here. In the seven instructions that are part of the 10 statements that he etched in stone, it is true that all of the instructions were written in the imperfect. Now, that means that we shouldn't make a practice of killing. We should not make a practice of adultery. We shouldn't make a habit of bearing false witness. We shouldn't, on a continual basis, covet that which is not ours. And so, by writing them that way, God is not saying that once is okay. He's just saying that he does not want us to continue in that behavior. And that continuing in the behavior will absolutely estrange us from him. And so it doesn't mean by written in the imperfect and saying don't do this on a continual basis doesn't make doing it once or twice and stopping okay. It simply means that it's the ongoing behavior that in those specific things is so troubling. And I could look up, and I haven't recently, but
I could look up on
incest and bestiality and pedophilia. But my guess is, based upon this, that once isn't okay.
Okay. I got the answer. So,
okay.
So then next one.
Okay.
Earlier in your discussions, you have said that there is a test, ultimate test, on how to tell who is speaking from Yahweh and
yes,
who is actually mm-hmm. trying to deceit.
Right.
Is there any test, some kind of genetic test maybe, and onto which you can tell who is a true Yahudim or the one from those DNA chain people, and who is not? I mean, and who is just going?
Yeah, really, they're separate. They're really separate entirely. But let's speak to both of them. The test to know who is speaking for Yahweh when they claim to be an inspired prophet. Now, mind you, I am never claiming to be an inspired prophet. But many people have, like Paul claimed to be and Muhammad claimed to be. And so if someone claims to be an inspired prophet, God is saying, I understand that you might question as to who, if that person is really speaking for me. And the test is provided in Devarim, Deuteronomy 13, and another one in 18. And so Yahweh provides the means for us to determine with absolute certainty whether someone spoke for him or they were lying. And if you apply that test to Muhammad or to Paul, they fail every aspect of that test, and you can therefore determine that you should not trust Paul or Muhammad, if you, whether you're a Christian or a Muslim. Now, the second one part of it is, is focused on the chosen people. And the chosen people are the descendants of Abraham and Sarah through Yishak and then through Jacob. And so you would be correct that there would be a DNA marker that would follow all the way down from Sarah and Abraham through Yishak, through Jacob, that would be traceable should you have Abraham and Sarah's DNA to determine who, in fact, is a Yahudim, Yahudah, really, which is corrupted to Jew, or a Yisraelite. The 12 tribes are collectively Yisrael. One of the tribes is Yahudah. And yes, the answer is the answer to the question is yes. But you and I can't determine this because we do not have Abraham's and Sarah's DNA, nor Yishak's DNA, nor Jacob's DNA. If we had it, we would be able to determine that. But I know somebody who does.
Who? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the author of the covenant. So that's how, you know, when you get to the last days and Yahweh is still fixated on his chosen people. This is one of the really important things that Christians have really screwed up, and so have Muslims, in terms of who Yahweh is and what he's telling us. The Torah, Prophets, and Psalms is not the story of humankind. It's the story of the chosen people. And the only time that those other than the chosen people are even mentioned is when they interact, usually negatively, with the chosen people. And so Yahweh is, right at the beginning, focused on his family through Abraham and his wife Sarah, through Yishak and Jacob, who he renames Israel. And in the story never changes. The focus never changes all the way to the end, where Yahweh is going to reconcile his relationship with Israel and with Yahudah. And so he is going to have to answer the question that you asked.
So then those who don't know their Yahudim and they're doing all the wrong things, they will be their eyes will be opened up at the end, in the end?
Many of them will, absolutely. Many will. We'll address this more when we return. But the answer to the question is absolutely. It's kind of an interesting perspective. But this conversation between Nick and Glenn began with fighting words. Nick said, and Nick is one of my very favorite callers into this program, said that he thought that Glenn's suggestion was naive. Now, if you're someone who is as well-read, as informed and rational as Glenn almost consistently is, then those would be fighting words. And yet what we've ended up with, by not escalating the conflict, but instead engaging in discussion, is something that has been mutually beneficial, enjoyable, enlightening. This is what I wish we were training police officers to do, is the very thing that has transpired here into something that I think has been educational for all of us and enjoyable for all of us, because we're having a discussion about important questions and the and answers. In fact, one of those times where I provided an answer, Nick, I gave two answers and you gave one. I like yours better than I like mine. I don't think it negates mine, but I certainly think it makes yours better. And so all the benefit of exchanging ideas.
Anytime the things being simplified, and it's just always better in terms of understanding and or can we pass.
I would agree. I would agree. Particularly with the covenant, because you want to get right down to the basics. All God wants is for us to answer his invitation to be part of his family.
So,
to trust him in that regard.
Next one.
Mm-hmm.
Genesis 14:22. And Abram said to the king of Satan, Sadon, I have lifted up my hand to Yahweh, the Most High El. Now, isn't that that's the only El? Why is it the Most High El?
There's
no other El.
Yeah. Yeah. Throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, the title God, El, is from Eloah. It's a contraction of Eloah. And Elohim, which is the plural of El, meaning almighties, if you will. It is used to describe both God's real and false. And what he is, while Yahweh is the only real El, and therefore it sounds a little awkward to say the Most High God, what Eloah actually means is the Most High. It means mighty. It means almighty. So he's really defining what El means here, as opposed to trying to say, well, yeah, he's the top God and there's other gods underneath him. That's not the what's being conveyed here. What's being conveyed is an actual definition of what Eloah and therefore El means.
But it says the Most High El. In one
that means
sentence,
right.
Thing,
he's defining El. El means Most High.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what's being communicated there. One of the things that a lot of people reject everything that I say and write because I use the English word God. And they think, oh, well, that's just terrible because God said that the names of false gods should not be on your lips. El is not a name. It's a title. God is not a name. It's a title. He didn't say that false titles should never be on your lips. And what he actually said is that he didn't want us to memorialize, goes right back to the Babel thing. You know, you're trying to memorialize your own names. What God doesn't want us to do is to promote false gods like Jesus, like Allah, like Zoroaster, you know, in his religion. Does not want us to promote the names of false gods like Grace in Pauline Christianity. Don't do that. But to use the title God, Yahweh uses Elohim routinely to describe false gods.
Okay.
A false god's not real. And yet they exist. You follow how a false god can be real and not exist?
And I understand this more than an average bear, and I understand it faster a little bit too. So I understood it a while ago, but I suppose this radio show is not just for me. So
that is correct.
I'm fine waiting with your explanation. However, I do have a next topic to.
Okay, go ahead.
And it's about difference between languages, and especially the one, the Russian kind and the English, and I suppose the Hebrew too. So we'll be talking about Sukkah.
Okay, when we return, we'll talk about Sukkah and the differences between Russian, English, and Hebrew. Part of that I'll be able to speak to. Not much on the difference between Russian and English, however. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shatteringness. Nick has said that he wants to make a point about the similarities or the differences between English, Russian, and Hebrew. And normally, you know, I'd love to be able to prepare to provide an answer, but I'm going to tell you on this one, my friend Nick, when it comes to comparing English and Russian, it's all you.
Okay. Before we do that, may I address the El for just a second?
Sure.
On the title El, there are a few complexities about that, and also like on the Most High God issue. Mm-hmm. First of all, with El, you'll sometimes hear people assert that El is an actual name of the god Saturn. You know, from the Saturnian cultists using El as an appellation for Saturn. And they'll say, well, why is El used in the Old Testament if it's if it's the name of a pagan god? And, why isn't it rebuked like the way Baal is? And the important point there is that it is like a title as opposed
right.
to a name.
Right.
And that's why we why it's okay for it to be at the end of Daniel and Nathaniel
right.
and Ezekiel. You know,
right.
there's
yes.
the references in like the, what's the proper pronunciation for like Jeremiah? You know, like in some of the prophets, you have the
Yirmiyah.
You have Yah, or yeah, or if you see the Haya right. in there, you know, that's a reference
yeah.
to Yah. And with the L, it's a reference to the title. So, you know,
The Yos are references to Yahweh.
Right.
All of the Yos, Yoel, Yosef.
Right.
Yes.
Right. So it's not
yeah.
anathema to have the L in there. It's not, you know, there are people who create confusion about the name Saturn, or like pictures of Saturn,
right.
you know, where he's labeled as L, you know.
Yeah.
That's,
there was, there actually was, to my knowledge, there never has been a god named God. There has been a Gad, and there is a Got. But there, to my knowledge, there has never been a God named God. And as such, it's a title, it's not a name, and it's the Hebrew word El Elohim Eloah, speak of the Most High. It's interesting too when you get into Paleo Hebrew how that word is written. But
yeah.
before we go any deeper into that, Nick had another question about comparing the languages.
Well, okay. I have 1 second before, and then I'll bow out.
Okay.
Sure.
On the Most High God thing,
yes.
you have this contrast between monotheism versus polytheism, and you also have the introduction of the term henotheism, you know, it's trying to deal with this in-between state with where you have this reference to non-existent gods.
Right.
You know, like the, you know, the Most High God, or the Bible references, or, you know, references to, the gods who are no gods, you know, it's clear that they are non-existent. And
right.
So sometimes you'll in theology, sometimes see the term henotheism, you know,
right.
attributed, applied to
right.
that as a descriptor. And one last thing when you talk about Eloah, I often, and this is just an aside, I often wonder about words like aloha, you know, among the Hawaiians, or Yahoo coming up among Native Americans.
Yes.
Like, I gotta wonder, it seems to me like that name, you know, had an effect on these languages.
Right.
A long, long time ago.
Yes, it does. And, of course, they all migrated out of a place where they could have known it a very long time
right.
ago. We're in agreement there.
Okay,
all right, Nick. Thank you. Thank you, Glenn. All great input. Nick, you had want to make a comparison between English, Russian, and Hebrew.
So I'm going to inject a little bit fun into a conversation
okay.
comparing English and Russian. And,
okay.
And well, you do understand, and I think I even heard you saying that it's fun to learn other languages too.
Yes, I agree.
And one of those fun moments when you do learn English when you are Russian is that word through, the one
correct.
That says yes, the one that says I'm walking through the door. That
right.
word is just so much fun. I don't know. I think everyone.
Right.
had fun trying to pronounce it because they were laughing too much.
The way that it's written in English?
The yeah. way it's being pronounced.
Yes, through.
In Russian, that word means taking shiznit. and when we're trying to say the word through, it's just like, oh my God, how can you? First you have to just stop laughing before you even try to. And so,
yeah.
And
I always think it's funny too that like through, T H R E W, as in you threw the ball, and then through with the O U sounds through the door. They're both pronounced exactly the same, and they speak of entirely different things.
Well,
and so, when you're
Russia,
listening, context tells you what's happening.
We don't have no z or th in Russia, so
okay.
to say through, we have to figure out how to put that tongue together with teeth to actually put that. And we have to in Russian actually the word is through in Russia, but basically what you do with that S is you
try to say F with your tongue in between your teeth, and then you're gonna have that F effect. And
oh, okay.
So that's how. But it's just like, I mean, it was hard to learn that one particular word.
Oh yeah. You know, one of the things is also interesting. You're talking about with your tongue and your lips being together, that sort of thing. Is that the concept of vowels and consonants? You know, I was always perplexed by what do they mean that Hebrew, for example, has five vowels and 17 consonants among the 22 letters, but your description of where the tongue goes and how you pronounce words and sounds with, for example, an F, which is a consonant, it's that all consonants begin or end with a closed mouth, where all vowels have as their basis an open mouth. So it's just the way that languages, and all languages have consonants and vowels, and how they are spoken to create a spoken language.
So now here's the
Okay.
Here comes the conspiracy.
Okay.
From me too, by the way.
Okay.
Anyway, the sukkah.
Mm-hmm.
What we're celebrating? Refresh mm-hmm. my memory. What is sukkah? It's
sukkah means shelters in Hebrew. It's about pitching a tent and camping out with the Yahweh.
Mm-hmm. It's something you're celebrating, right?
Right. You're celebrating sukkah. Sukkah is the conclusion of the Moed Mikre. The Moed Mikre are assigned meetings that we're invited to be called out and to meet with God, to be welcomed into His company. And the doorway that they begin with is Pesach, Passover. And they conclude, the six steps conclude with the seventh, which is to camp out with God. And he's basically saying as you walk through the doorway of life and across the threshold of unyeasting bread, then you are adopted into his family on Bukurim, and then on Shabuah, you're empowered and enriched on Teruah. You're then enabled to convey Yahweh's message, which is that he wants to reconcile Yom Kippurim, his relationship with his children, and that leads to the end result of us camping out with Yahweh together for all time.
Well, in Russian, that one particular word,
sukkah,
in exact pronunciation, means, I'm not sure even if I can say that word in English on the radio, but it's something what you call a female dog or a woman that behaves the same way.
Yeah, yeah. In the reference to the female dog, you can use the you know,
B word.
The B word. You can say bitch on the radio when you're describing a female dog. Now, that is not the connotation of the word used in everyday language. Someone is the B word when they are naggy and when they're acting selfishly and their behavior is unbecoming. They're labeled with the B word. And so what you're saying is that sukkah in Russian is a naggy and selfish, immoral woman.
And so if I do ever bring the, I mean, I can guarantee I'll have tears at me at first. Like, celebrating what?
Celebrating what? Why are we celebrating that B-I-T-C-H? That's funny.
That's where the fun comes from.
You know, and part of the challenge here is that in all honesty, we all think in our native language. So you've learned English as a second language, and you're learning Hebrew as a third language, but you still think in Russian. We all think in our native language. So even when I'm reading Hebrew, I still think in English.
Actually, I've been here long enough where I don't think in Russian. That's why one of the reasons why my kids don't speak Russian, because it takes time for me to translate it to Russian, so then I could actually tell them what I want them to do or understand in Russian. Because I first thought about it in English, and so it's only, I mean, you can only
this is just the beginning stage of actually, you know, learning the different language, or what do you call melting pot is what.
Right. Yeah, sure. No, I think so what you're doing for your children is actually beneficial. I want to just ask you a question. Are you a first-generation immigrant from Russia, or did your parents come here from Russia and you were born here?
No, my parents are still in Russia. They're not
okay.
Here. I'm here all alone. And
okay. And what caused you to leave Russia, and what part? Russia is a huge area. What part of Russia are you from?
Well, over by Rostov, and that Ukraine stuff that's going on, it's just right there with me. I can, if I ever will have nothing to do, I know I can go, you know, join the crew and start shooting.
All right, which side would your town be on? Is it in the
Rostov?
Yes.
Rostov?
Yes. Is it near Kiev, or is it near
Lugansk and Donetsk?
Oh, it is. So you would since the 2/3 of those in Donetsk and Lugansk are ethnic Russians and Russian speakers, would you consider yourself?
I have relatives in Odessa too.
Okay, so you are. Would you be ethnically Russian?
Well, I'm actually half and half. My father is Ukrainian. My mom is Russian.
Oh, okay. Well, if you can stay with us for this last segment, we only have 6 minutes to go. But I would love your feedback, since I've spent so much time trying to help people better understand the Ukrainian situation. Your insights, having come from there, I would love to hear. Welcome back to the final segment of Shattering Myths. Today we're going to go to a subject we've talked a lot about on this program, but not actually mentioning today, although it's a lot of events today, and that busloads of refugees were bombed, with the rebels saying that the Kiev regime did it, and the Kiev regime saying that the rebels did it. What do you think about this mess, Nick? And what do you think?
Just like you said in your previous, if they would stop funding the killing, then the killing would stop.
Correct.
The America does.
Right. Yeah. Americans are funding the Ukrainian military to wage war against those who do not want to be part of the Kiev regime.
How are they gonna? But
right.
Now because of all the killing that have been already perpetrated, I'm not sure that those who is on the Lugansk and Donetsk side would actually stop, because I'm sure people on that side want revenge.
Correct.
Unless that one president, the Chocolate King, will go to jail, I think that's probably the only thing that will actually put down
right.
Most of the...
Unless there's independence granted to those who want independence, I don't think there's any way this will ever end.
That's probably not going to be enough. I think that those guys who
right.
perpetrate the killing will have to go to jail. Otherwise, the blood will not stop.
I just can't imagine the hypocrisy, though, of America.
Yeah.
You know, America started this whole thing, and then we scream at the Russians for enabling the ethnic Russians who want independence of the Kiev regime, giving them the means to defend themselves, and yet we actually pay for the Kiev regime to bombard major cities. We are so immoral in this whole presentation of what's occurring there.
And I'm not just, I don't just have a, you know, my ex-wife, relatives actually live in Lugansk, and my friend that was working with me at one of the dairy farms on that one same J-1 visa that we have used to come here and work one of the dairy farms. He went back, of course, to Lugansk, and he's in Lugansk, and he's got his own thing in business, and he's like scared that, you know, his boss will be his newly acquired boss that he bought before the conflict to do the give right to tourists and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Have them, you know, go back and forth to the Black Sea, I think.
Right.
So yeah, he's scared that his stuff is gonna get.
Right.
And if you ever and if you ever would want, you know, risk your life, I think I can get you and him together, and you can go ahead and take your camera and start recording stuff. I'm warning you that if you're American there, it's not a good thing.
Not a good thing, no, because America's on the wrong side here. We started the riots in Kiev. We funded them. We encouraged them. And then when the Kiev regime was opposed by ethnic Russians in Crimea and through the Donetsk and Luhansk region, we opposed the people being able to defend themselves, and we encouraged the violence. So if I was in that region, I would despise Americans. You'd have every reason to. You're being killed. Your city is being ransacked with artillery and bombed from the air because of America.
From the moment the Soviet Union failed,
right,
America was so popular in there.
Yes.
In my teenage years, there was songs about written about America. There was like popular artists who was rooting for America. We had so much love for America that is absolutely being destroyed left to right, and it's just like opposite in all of the there's like it's just
for good reason
how easy and fast and guys feel.
Boy, I hear you, and I agree with you. America did many good things for a very long time and earned respect that we have absolutely squandered by our belligerence in the last 50 years. So, but in this case, it's only really 20 years. 20 years ago, you were singing the praises of America being free from communism and the old Soviet Union, and now are condemning America for the civil war that it has brought upon your people.
Well,
love to talk. Yeah, I'd love to talk to you more about this as we review these conditions going forward. Thank you, guys.